Life of Jesus, a devotional study by Melva Purkis. Chapter 2, The Religious Rulers. None of the classes of people who exercised authority over the Jews emerged with much credit from their contacts with Jesus. In varying degree, they were all the objects of his censure, and on one occasion, Jesus specifically warned his disciples to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, the Sadducees, and of Herod. It is important that we understand something of the influence which these parties had, and how that influence permeated like leaven through the whole nation, moulding its thought and shaping its action. The picture which is revealed is not a pretty one. There is much in it to emphasise the words of Jeremiah, that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. The people of God grievously failed to rise to their privileges, and without the grace of God in sending his Son into the world to accomplish salvation, all men would have been eternally lost. Superficially, the Jewish nation seemed religious to the point of fanaticism. But a closer scrutiny discloses those elemental passions which have characterized nations with no pretensions to high ideals. It is true that a few wealthy families advocated the study of the scripture, but their motive was not to turn the people to God so much as to confound the growing power of the rivals they hated. So far from submitting to the influence of scriptures themselves, they were pagan worldlings patronizing Greek culture and ingratiating themselves with Rome, enforcing the religious obligations which so bountifully produced their wealth. The scribes, on the other hand, used their high office of instructing the people in the understanding of God's law to glorify their own learning, giving their expositions a higher place than the law and the prophets, and introducing a system of casuistry, quibbling, which obscured the direct teaching of Scripture. While the Pharisees proved an ideal foil for the subtleties of the scribes, ostentatiously following the traditions of the elders at street corners and in marketplace. Such were the powers ruling the lives of the people in the days of Jesus. With his intimate knowledge of Scripture, each visit to Jerusalem after that memorable journey at the age of 12 would show the perversity and corruption into which the people were drawn from God under the guise of serving him. To his sensitive spirit, it must have been a test of patient discipline to refrain from exposing it. But the time came when the floodgates of his indignation burst. The cumulative effect of his anger descended upon those blind leaders, and they felt the withering power of his indictments. Let us look more closely at these men, their systems, and their motives. The scribes had degenerated from the high office they had held for centuries when, hidden from public gaze and secure from the temptations of popularity, they had spent their lives reverently copying the books of Scripture, using special ink upon the skin of a clean animal, counting every letter and pronouncing each word aloud before writing it. In those days, the scriptures were held in such awe that if, on examining a completed sheet, one letter was found to be wrong, the whole sheet was destroyed. So conscious were they of the sacredness of their task that they would wipe their pens before writing the name of God and wash their bodies before writing the four letters of the covenant name. The deterioration was a slow process, and as is so often the case, began in apparently the most innocent ways. It became a practice for the decisions of the rabbis on difficult interpretations of the law of Moses to be recorded. As these reports grew in volume, classification became necessary. In course of time, the further commentaries and discussions aroused were compiled and formed the Mishnah. Ultimately, the scope widened, and anecdotes of school and courtroom mingled with Jewish experiences and superstitions found their way into another compilation of writings known as the Gemara. Mishnah and Gemara together were later to become known as the Talmud, and a knowledge of this composite work was considered the necessary doctrine and erudition of the learned Jew. These writings came to be honoured above the law itself, and it was a greater crime to offend against them than to break the commands of God. But at the time of Jesus, these developments had not assumed their final shape. The great distinction was that between the written law of Moses and the oral law of tradition. Meanwhile, the scribe himself had changed. He had emerged from his quiet seclusion and became the religious authority in Israel, ruling in the synagogue, teaching in the schools and in the temple courts, arbitrating in civil and family disputes, and instructing in matters of secular and ceremonial difficulty. In the Gospels, we find constant references to the scribes, who are also alluded to as rabbis, lawyers, and doctors of the law. The greatest of the scribes had schools of their own at which they taught the young. Several of them toured the countryside with their disciples and were invited to minister in the synagogues of the towns through which they passed. But the majority took up their residence in the towns and villages of Judea, and particularly Galilee, where they supervised the people in the synagogues and their children in the adjoining schools. As might be expected, where the deliberations of men had so largely superseded the wisdom of God, there were several significant and fundamental differences within the ranks of the scribes. Two rival schools were most prominent during the ministry of Christ, those of Shammai and Hillel. Both schools had emerged during the century before Christ came, although as Hillel lived to be well over 100, it is possible that he was one of the doctors of the law who interviewed Jesus in the temple on his visit at the age of 12. The school of Shammai, whose founder was as rich as he was careless of the stringency of his own code, was rigidly orthodox and was responsible for the unlovely extremes of ceremonial which Jesus condemned. The rival school of Hillel was led by a man of gentle and genial poverty, tolerant to the point of looseness in some of his rulings. One of the most noticeable disagreements was on the question of divorce. The school of Shammai insisted upon adultery being the only legal ground, while Hillel taught that a man may put away his wife on the flimsiest of pretexts, even for not adequately catering for his material necessities. When the people accepted Jesus as a rabbi, the Pharisees' question on divorce, "Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for any cause?" was not to elicit information so much as to find out whether his sympathies lay with the school of Shammai or of Hillel. In this instance, Jesus showed that the school of Shammai was nearer the true attitude by virtue of its reflection of the teaching of Scripture. But generally, it was this school which received the greater censure at his hands. Most of the scribes were also Pharisees, although a small number in Judea belonged to the Sadducees. The Pharisees were by far the largest religious party among the Jews at the time of Christ. numbering, according to Josephus, 6,000. Though the great majority of them were ordinary middle-class Jews, they were closely associated with the scribes, most of whom were prominent members. To no small extent the scribes owed their power and authority to the Pharisees, whose chief interest was to give their findings strict and ostentatious observance. Yet they maintained a certain independence by their insistence that God had given Moses an oral as well as a written law, and that the oral law had been passed to the men of the great synagogue successively through Joshua, the elders of Israel, and the prophets. Although this belief was destitute of historical evidence, it had won general acceptance, and in their efforts to keep it with all its subsequent ramifications, the Pharisees had imposed upon themselves and those under their influence a burden too heavy to bear. In their meticulous observance of frivolous decisions, which at lowest level had degenerated to the refusal to eat an egg laid on the Sabbath, the simple beauty of true worship and communion was utterly lost. While their constant efforts to maintain the tradition in all its weak and beggarly elements diverted their attention from God and turned them into self-satisfied and complacent hypocrites. Unlike the Sadducees, the majority of the Pharisees were neither wealthy nor opulent. They lived temperate, sometimes frugal lives, and won widespread respect among the people who felt that they were witnessing religion practiced at its highest level. However sincere many of the Pharisees may have been, they were always fighting a losing battle against the system to which they were devoted. That system bred hypocrisy, and in warning his disciples against the leaven of the Pharisees, it was this inevitable hypocrisy to which Jesus alluded. It produced men who, shrouded in their own conscious sense of goodness, stood aloof from the vulgar crowd, and praying with themselves, thanked God that they were not as other men. The tragedy of their condition was exposed by Jesus when, answering their indignant question, "Are we blind also?" he replied, "If ye were blind, ye should have no sin. But now ye say, we see. Therefore your sin remaineth." A physician cannot cure a sick man who insistently protests he is in perfect health, and has not the slightest intention of submitting to an examination or listening to a diagnosis of his condition. Thus the very sincerity of the Pharisees was an impediment to him. Such was the system to which he was in bondage. And there were sincere Pharisees in Israel at the time of Christ, particularly in Galilee, where, before interference came from Jerusalem, Jesus was accepted as a rabbi and invited to preach in their synagogues. But there were the unadulterated hypocrites too, men who for a pretense made long prayers, parading their religion in public places and shedding it like a cloak in the seclusion of their private lives. Human nature being what it is, it was inevitable that the system should breed such men, and it was the system Jesus attacked with all the power of his vital nature. We have good reason to believe that the denunciations which are recorded in the Gospels were addressed to the leaders of the Pharisees, who were primarily responsible for the low spiritual condition of the people. The scribes were also Pharisees, and who, in the deepest sense, were the real hypocrites. The Sadducees were a much smaller party and were confined to Jerusalem and its neighbourhood. Unlike the Pharisees, they made no effort to increase their membership, which was probably only a few hundreds. They comprised the chief priests and their families and amassed their great wealth from the temple system. For this reason, they did all they could to encourage religious worship. But their hearts were far from God. They were worldly men with political interests rather than godly men with religious convictions. There was very real antagonism between them and the scribes and Pharisees, but their religious differences were made the excuse for more sinister ambitions. The chief theological issue between the two parties concerned the tradition. The Sadducees, refusing to accept the teaching of the scribes that Moses was given an oral law. This was fundamental, and meant that they set aside as almost worthless the teaching which the scribes held to be more important than the law of Moses. The Sadducees contended that the Pentateuch was more important and more authoritative than the remainder of the Old Testament. They rejected the belief in the resurrection and a future life because they thought it was not taught in the first five books of Scripture. It is interesting to notice that when Jesus refuted their hypothetical case of the woman who had seven husbands, he referred them to Exodus, neglecting more impressive evidence from later books, because he knew they would refuse to accept such authority. More subtle and far-reaching was the difference in outlook between the two parties. The scribes and Pharisees, with all their faults, were intensely nationalistic and loyal to the Jewish faith they had so unhappily complicated and diluted. But the Sadducees, while fostering the national features upon which they depended for their affluence and power, looked further afield. They sought to introduce Greek culture and played the dangerous game of expediency with the Roman court. As economic distress grew in Palestine, so the Sadducees became more unpopular, until they began to lose seats to the Pharisees in the great Sanhedrin itself, where before they had undisputed monopoly. After the terrible disaster of AD 70, the Sadducees disappeared completely from Jewish life. The Great Sanhedrin was the supreme council of the Jews. It consisted of 71 members, and the Mishnah traced its origin to the 70 men whom God instructed Moses to appoint to help him bear the burdens of governing the children of Israel. Although this incident may have inspired the creation of the Sanhedrin in later times, it seems certain that the divine arrangement with Moses was of a temporary nature, and subsequent references to the elders of Israel are intermittent and vague. The Great Sanhedrin met in a hall in the temple courts, and there it exercised its judicial power in all important ecclesiastical, civil, and criminal cases. It is important to remember that in practice there were no such divisions. The Jews were a theocratic people, and hence all cases were fundamentally religious. If therefore a man stole, he would be indicted both for a criminal offence and a religious one in breaking the law. Similarly, in the event of a claim for damages or any other matter, which we should regard as a civil case, it resolved itself into the ruling of the Mosaic law, and was thus truly a religious matter. The Sanhedrin had extremely wide powers. Only in cases where the death penalty was prescribed was it necessary to have their sentence confirmed by the Roman procurator. In addition to the Great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, there were similar councils in all the towns and larger villages of Palestine. These seem to have originated beyond the boundaries of the Holy Land among the Jews of the dispersion, who felt the need for the authority of a council and the worship of a synagogue. The councils of Palestine were more under the control of the Jerusalem Sanhedrin, which appointed their members and heard the more difficult cases that were brought before them, acting as a supreme court of appeal. The members of the local Sanhedrins were usually the rulers of the synagogue. Exercising a firm and intimate control over the people, they were able to introduce a system of sanctions against any who incurred their displeasure and had been cast out of the synagogue. The parents of the man born blind were in danger of losing their livelihood by making any statement which supported the claims of Jesus and invalidated official criticism of him. The synagogues were distributed widely throughout the towns and villages of Palestine, affording the Jews the opportunity of simple weekly worship, which consisted of prayers and a reading and exposition of the law and the prophets. The ruler of the synagogue was usually a Pharisee scribe, who also taught in the adjoining school and presided over the local Sanhedrin. Behind this system of worship and jurisprudence stood the great temple on Mount Moriah, exercising its powerful unifying influence over the whole Jewish world, rising far above the puny ambitions and strifes of men. Every boy was brought up to believe that here was the point of contact between him and the God of Israel. Here the high priest went each year into the presence of God to confess the people's sins and to make reconciliation. Hither the Jews flocked for the three principal feasts of the year, filling the town and the surrounding hills. Here the messianic hopes found their focus. Yet the thoughtful Jew saw little prospect of national deliverance through the temple system, maintained by men who sought only its own ends and strove in bitter enmity with rivals who in turn had transformed the law of God into a complex system of ceremonial observance. Disheartened by the growing economic distress, dissatisfied with religious leaders who took everything and offered little in return, his messianic hope was strong but vague. It was necessary for the long, silent voice of the prophets to be heard again, to give life and substance to the longing which lay dormant in the hearts of God's people.